Good morning, members. The Health and Human Services Committee will come to order. Members, please take your seats. If you have, when Cheryl calls the roll, please remember to push the little white button, and there's a circle around the base of it that will let you know that your microphone is on. So if we'll begin, Cheryl, would you please call the roll?
Chair Burton?
Here.
Representatives Altman?
Here.
Benjamin?
Bettina? Here.
Bettina?
Here.
Caruso?
Here.
Davis?
Here.
Duran?
Here.
Garrison?
Here.
Grant?
Here.
Coster?
Here.
Masulo?
Here.
Mello?
Here.
Persons Malika?
Here.
Rayner?
Here.
Rizzo?
Here.
F. Robinson?
Here.
W. Robinson is excused. Reps Ravoy is excused. Representative Skidmore?
Here.
Tant?
Here.
Yarbrough?
Here.
Quorum is present.
Turn my mic on. Thank you, Cheryl, and good morning, everybody. We have as we begin this meeting, I'm going to ask everybody not just to silence your cell phone, but also if it vibrates, please turn that function off as well, because these new mics we have in the committee room are really hot, and they will pick up even the vibration. Members, this committee has broad authority over all healthcare and human services programs. Our jurisdiction includes Medicaid, facility and professional regulation, public health, mental health and substance abuse, child welfare, health insurance, and many other complex areas. We cover several state agencies, Department of Children and Families, Agency for Healthcare Administration, Department of Health, Agency for Persons with Disabilities, Department of Elder Affairs, Department of Veterans Affairs in their nursing home issues, Office of Insurance Regulation and their health insurance coverage issues. So as you know, for those of you particularly who've been returning, we've got some changing in our committee schedule. Rather than meeting every week during committee weeks for a couple of hours, we have limited time this session. So we won't have time to do introductory presentations from the agencies. And for newer members, that would be something that we have done in the past. We will not be doing that. So instead, you're each going to be emailed a packet, a briefing material, covering the jurisdiction of the three subcommittees under HHS. Some of you serving on the subcommittees may have already received your subcommittee materials, but please take some time before our next meeting to review these materials, get familiar with the types of challenges we work on in HHS. We'll be tackling some interesting issues this session, and I look forward to working with each and every one of you over the next 2 years. When you're reviewing those packets, should you have any questions, I would ask you to begin by going to perhaps your sub-chair, if you're on a subcommittee, the chair of your subcommittee, for those of you who, or you can call my office, or certainly our more than able staff is available to you. We're gonna do quick introductions. As we have 1 hour, we have a very interesting panel today, so we wanna take as much time for the panel as we possibly can. We'll start by, though I also wanna introduce you, if you haven't met them already, our superstar staff. That's all S's. Superstar S. To my right, we have Krista Kalamis. Krista is the staff director for health. So she's literally my right-hand person, but really everybody's right-hand person. So please, take advantage of the great knowledge and experience she has. And on my left, we have Cheryl DeWeese. Cheryl is going to just like breeze us through this first time when we've used remote access to all of our speakers, and Aaron is around. Aaron Osborne is with us too from the office, so thanks for being here, all three of you. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce a few other people up here, sitting at the dais with me. We have, to my right, again, we have Vice Chair Grant. Vice Chair Grant, thank you for being here. And over to my left, immediate left, we have our ranking member, Duran. And so good morning, Representative Duran. What I'm going to do, members, is we're going to go kind of quickly. In the past, those of you who've been here, you might have told us a little bit of your life story when we do introductions this morning. I'm afraid we're not going to do that. Maybe we'll have time for that at some other point, but let's try to just do a quick introduction. And Chair Yarbrough, I will start with you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Good morning to you and the members. Clay Yarbrough from House District 12 in Jacksonville, and honored to serve as your Finance and Facilities Subcommittee Chair. Thank you. Thank you.
Thad Altman. I'm honored to serve in the Subcommittee for Children, Families, and Elderly Affairs. I'm from East Central Florida, the Melbourne Cocoa Beach area.
Allison Tant, State Rep, House District 9, Tallahassee. You're in my district. Welcome. Love having you here. Stay safe while you're here. We're in a surge. Love being on this committee and anxious to get to work.
Felicia Robinson, House District 102, South Broward covers parts of Pines, Miramar, and North Dade, parts of Miami Gardens. Happy to be on this committee, looking forward to work with you all.
Good morning, I'm Kelly Skidmore from House District 81, which is South Florida, Boca Raton, Delray Beach, Boynton Beach, Lake Worth, and the beautiful area of the Glades. Happy to be here.
Christopher Benjamin, District 107, that is North Miami-Dade County, representing Miami Gardens, North Miami, North Miami Beach, some areas in between. And I'm happy to be on this committee and looking forward to working with everyone to make Florida a healthy and prosperous state.
Good morning, Adam Botana from Coastal Lee, Bonita Springs, Fort Myers Beach, Sanibel, Captiva. Chair Burton, thank you for having me this morning. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Mike Caruso from District 89. Honored to serve under you, Chair Burton. My district runs from Boca Raton to Singer Island along the eastern side of the county.
Good morning, colleagues. My name is Tracy Davis. I represent District 13 in Jacksonville, Florida, and looking forward to working with all of you on this committee.
Thank you, Chair Burton. Sam Garrison, House District 18, Northern Clay County. Excited to work with members of the committee. Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning, Tracy Koster. Thank you so much for having me, Chair. House District 64 covers about 70% in Hillsborough, about 30% Pinellas County.
Good morning, Ralph Masullo, House District 34, all of Citrus and a portion of Hernando County. It's a privilege for me to be on this committee, and I'm honored to serve under you, Madam Chair, whom I know will lead us to creating good policy for our state.
Good morning, Lauren Mello. I serve in House District 80, which is Collier and Hendry County. I am looking forward to serving on this committee, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jenna Persons-Mollica, House District 78, Fort Myers, Florida, and I'm honored and excited to serve under your leadership.
Good morning, members. Michelle Rayner, House District 70, so it's a little bit of Pinellas, a little bit of Manatee, a little bit of Sarasota, and a little bit of Hillsborough County. I am very excited to be on this committee. This is a very important committee and very important work that we're doing, so thank you, Chair.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair. It's an honor to be here with every single one of you. Alex Rizzo from House District 110, which encompasses a portion of Hialeah, Miami Lakes, and unincorporated Miami-Dade.
Good morning. Nick Duran, House District 112, which includes cities of Miami, Coral Gables, and Village of Key Biscayne. An honor to work with you, Madam Chair.
Representative Mike Grant, Charlotte County, which is District 75. Glad to be here.
All right, thank you. And again, welcome to all of our members. We're kicking off to our first committee meeting with a very certainly important topic. As you know, we've been living through COVID, and I want to thank all the members. I see everybody's following the protocols, the House protocols, and that is something that we are going to be doing in our committee, I know, throughout the pandemic and as long as those protocols are in place. So thank you all for working with everybody on those protocols. But as you know, the pandemic is presenting daily challenges, new challenges always, for Floridians, their businesses, and the healthcare industry, and all levels of government. Today, we're exploring the issue of civil liability for healthcare providers with what I hope will be a robust panel discussion. And since I've met many of you on this panel, on our committee, I'm sure that will happen, and our panelists, I know will be more than able to participate robustly as well. Members, as you can see, we've got the new technology set up in here. For those of you with eyesight like mine, you really appreciate the big screens, so we're happy to have this going. We have really amazing sound system that enables us to speak with our mics on, with our masks on. So this is the first time we've done this. Cheryl has rehearsed. We're ready to roll, ready to roll. So forming our panel today, we're going to be talking about COVID liability protection, which you all know. You've got the bios of our presenters and some additional information in your packets that were emailed to you. On our panel today, we have Amanda Maggard, President and CEO, Advent Health Hospital System, Zephyr Hills and Dade City. Dr. Jason Goldman, a physician from Boca Raton. Mel Beal, CEO of Aramid Health Services, a long-term care provider. Thomas Edwards, who's an attorney with Edwards and Ragatz, PA in Jacksonville. And Sam Brooks, an attorney and project manager with Consumer Voice in Washington, D.C. Thank you all for joining us this morning from afar. We appreciate you being part of our conversation. We're going to ask each panelist to speak for about 5 minutes, and then we're going to open up the meeting for member discussion and questions. And I know you're all prepared for this discussion. So let's get started so we can make best use of our time. We will begin with Amanda Maggard. Ms. Maggard, you are recognized.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to join you today. My name is Amanda Maggard, and while it may help or hurt my testimony, I feel I need to disclose to the committee that I am not related to Representative Randy Maggard, even though we both hail.
Excuse me, Ms. Maggard. Ms. Maggard, we're having a difficult time hearing you. I'm going to speak for everybody because I am. So could you speak maybe a little bit closer to your mic? Yeah.
Sure. I'll try that. Sorry, my video may be a little bad. Can you hear me better now?
No. If you would hold for 1 minute, please.
Sure.
Oh, there. Gotcha. Whatever happened, it's working.
Now?
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Okay.
You can start from the beginning.
I apologize for the video quality. Now you may sacrifice that a little bit as I'm holding my iPad. My laptop didn't cooperate this morning, so it wouldn't be a virtual meeting if we didn't have a technical snafu. Madam Chair, would you like me to start from the beginning?
Please do.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to join you today. My name is Amanda Maggard, and while it may help or hurt my testimony, I feel I need to disclose to the committee that I am not related to Representative Randy Maggard, even though we both hail from East Pasco County. I'm honored to serve as the president and CEO for Advent Health Dade City and Advent Health Zephyr Hills Hospitals. As the only national health system headquartered in Florida, Advent Health is proud to have grown from our beginnings in the Sunshine State to a network of more than 50 hospitals across 9 states. More than half of our facilities are here in Florida, where we employ nearly 45,000 people. As COVID struck early in 2020, Advent Health launched an incident command center, formed of clinical experts and leaders in supply chain, human resources, IT, hospital, and skilled nursing operations. In March, this group expanded to include operational leaders from throughout our organization. At this time, I joined our system-wide COVID incident command team, and now I lead Advent Health's COVID response. In the beginning, our healthcare system, like others throughout the country, faced significant challenges. Our clinical experts and infectious disease physicians worked tirelessly to keep up with the evolving and sometimes conflicting clinical guidance provided by various agencies as the world sought to understand this new virus. It was not yet known how the virus was spread, how to prevent transmission, or how the virus presented in various people. Our supply chain, stocked with materials made in China, was overwhelmed, threatening the supply of masks, gloves, gowns, and other personal protective equipment for team members and patients. To slow the spread, governing bodies directed healthcare providers throughout the state to suspend non-emergent surgeries and procedures from March through mid-May. Staffing stretched thin as hotspots throughout the country attracted our nurses and respiratory therapists with high-dollar contracts. Hospital and nursing home visitation was halted, disrupting communication with patients' families. Demand for COVID testing far outweighed supply. And yet we have stories of bravery from team members who provided extraordinary care in uncertain times. At our hospital here in Zephyr Hills, an intensive care nurse volunteered to care for one of our first seriously ill COVID patients, working six straight days to limit potential exposure to his coworkers and their loved ones. As the patient's condition worsened, the family wanted a priest to perform the anointing of the sick, but visitation restrictions prevented the clergy from coming to the bedside. The nurse, named Jason, asked for instructions and performed this anointing for the patient. Jason promised the patient's wife, who was homesick and in quarantine herself, that he would not let the patient die alone. Jason kept that promise. The patient passed away peacefully and with dignity as Jason held his hand. As a hospital executive, I take great pride in the leadership my industry has shown in the face of this pandemic. We have been at the forefront of innovative, sometimes experimental treatments. We stepped into the breach to assist nursing homes in the care of their residents. Our mayors, county commissioners, health departments, and community members across Florida have relied on us for governance, guidance, and support. However, as I'm sure you've all experienced in your roles as well, leadership at the front line comes with risks. In these unprecedented times, we urge you to help us mitigate these risks. The pandemic has forced changes in the delivery of care, and the liability implications are immense without greater protection. Because of delays in elective procedures and preventive screenings, cases may have gone undiagnosed for weeks or months. Science and medicine have evolved greatly over the past year, rendering some early treatments ineffective and proving other measures, like wearing a mask, to be one of the best methods to prevent transmission. We are grateful for the development of new treatments and medications. Our staffing-stretched hospitals are working to implement these treatments as quickly as possible, but the supply chain for them is not within our control and not always guaranteed. As the pandemic continues, healthcare providers must remain focused on serving the needs of our patients. That should be our focus, rather than the potential for defending unfounded lawsuits. I would respectfully ask the committee consider legislation that will protect healthcare providers who have been navigating an unknown disease and bravely stepping into harm's way. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Maggard. I will move on to Dr. Goldman. Dr. Goldman, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, distinguished members of the committee, for this opportunity to speak with you. I'm Dr. Jason Goldman, a private practice internal medicine physician in South Florida. I'm also the American College of Physicians liaison to the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and on the COVID work group, as well as treasurer for the Florida Medical Association. I want to bring up three really important issues regarding liability reform in the practice of medicine. I want to focus on the issue of being exposed to patients with unknown diagnosis of COVID, both risk to myself and my staff, the delay in procedures and diagnoses that could potentially lead to liability, and of course, the lack of supplies, protective equipment, testing, et cetera, that interfere with our ability to take care of patients. As a frontline physician, I see all patients who come in the door. I see everyone from the common cold to heart failure to cancer diagnoses and everything in between. This challenging pandemic has made it, of course, extremely difficult to practice medicine the way we did in previous years. That being said, we may not know when a COVID patient walks in the door, despite our best efforts to screen them, isolate them, and make sure that they pose as little risk to the patients as possible. As we know, some patients are without any symptoms, while others are extremely ill. I don't turn anyone away because that's my obligation and oath as a physician, and will continue to put myself at risk to take care of the patients that we serve in the state of Florida. With that, I still have to protect my staff as well as myself. And the issue of a patient coming in and either not being truthful with their symptoms or not knowing that they even have COVID symptoms puts them at great risk and puts us at great risk. So I worry that there may be an issue of staff being exposed as well as myself being exposed and the potential liability of that. Telehealth, while a very useful tool, does not replace the direct physician encounter. There are only so many things that you can do through telehealth services. The laying on of hands, examining a patient in person, is sometimes the only way you'll be able to get a proper diagnosis. And in addition, many individuals in the area do not have access to telehealth services. They do not have the bandwidth. They do not have the infrastructure. They do not have the finances to be able to have adequate telehealth, making it very difficult for those services to be utilized. So they have to come into the office. We do need liability reform to protect the physicians, the patients, and staff against unknowing transmission, even in the office setting or the hospital setting or other healthcare issues and healthcare settings where they could, in fact, get COVID unbeknownst to them. The other issue is delay in diagnosis and procedures. Many people hear the term elective and they think cosmetic procedures. That is not the case. Colonoscopies, hip replacements, knee replacements, evaluation for cancer, skin examinations, removal of various dermatological malignancies. Many of these, if left undiagnosed, can spread rapidly and lead to a terminal condition. And when the governor issued executive orders and closed down all elective procedures, it put the patients at risk for other conditions, even though we were trying to stop the spread of the pandemic. So patients were not able to get their routine procedures and evaluations. And what I'm seeing months later is diagnoses for cancer and other conditions that had to be delayed for obvious reasons. And I worry about the liability that they're going to now claim there was a delay in their cancer diagnosis through no fault of my own and no fault of the medical profession, but because we're in a pandemic and everything had to be shut down. So I really do want to stress the importance of understanding that elective does not mean cosmetic. Elective means non-urgent. You're not going in for the heart attack, but going in for a cardiac catheterization because you're having symptoms. That's an elective procedure as opposed to an emergency, and many of those were delayed. So we do worry about the medical profession being held accountable for situations beyond their control through no fault of their own being closed because of executive orders in a global pandemic. So that, of course, is a significant issue of delay of diagnosis where we need liability protection. And finally, the ability for us to practice the usual standard of care was grossly disrupted by lack of protective equipment, lack of testing supplies, inability for us to properly evaluate the patient. For months, I struggled to get even the simplest nasal swabs to be able to test my patients for COVID. So we had to make the assumption they had it, isolate them, but at the same token, it's not the standard of diagnosis that we would practice for any condition. Not having protective equipment, not having the ability to keep my staff in protection and in the office constantly made it very difficult. I'm only as good as the support staff I have. You know, as you mentioned, Madam Chair, with the wonderful staff that you have that helps you run your committee, well, a physician office is only as good as the staff they have. And if I can't protect my staff, many of whom are minorities and people of color who also are at great risk for COVID, I can't function. So the standard of care was grossly disrupted by the inability to have the protective equipment, testing supplies, and keep the staffing ratio up to what we need. So I worry about the long-term liability of being told that we couldn't take care of the patient properly, couldn't diagnose them, couldn't do what we need to do through a global pandemic where we were not able to meet the usual standards through no fault of our own, but because we were dealing with lack of a supply chain, lack of adequate testing, lack of protective gear. So those are really the three basic issues for why we feel we need liability reform in this time of COVID. These are unprecedented times, as we all know. We are literally trying to build the airplane and fly it at the same time. Obviously, it's an untenable position, but what we were doing as frontline healthcare workers, professionals, physicians, support staff, is do whatever we can to make sure we take care of the patients. I see my role as not only saving lives, but keeping the patients out of the hospital.
Excuse me,
and thank you for your time, and I appreciate the ability to speak to you today.
Thank you. Thank you. Now we're going to hear from Mel Beal. Mr. Beal, you are recognized. Excuse me one moment, Mr. Beal. We cannot hear you.
Sent him
You should have been sent a request to unmute, so you might have to unmute your on your computer.
Good morning.
There you are. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Sorry for the confusion. But thank you, Chair Burton, members of the committee, for the opportunity to ask you to pass COVID-19 liability protections. My name is Mel Beal. I'm part of a management consulting group representing six not-for-profit operators of 40 skilled nursing facilities and three assisted living facilities located across Florida. In the centers, there are over 5,300 healthcare heroes caring for over 4,300 of Florida's most vulnerable and frail seniors and people with disabilities. As COVID-19 first materialized last March, long-term care centers across Florida faced immediate and difficult circumstances. As the numbers show, Floridians age 65 and above, especially those 80 and above with underlying health conditions, are most vulnerable to the virus. These are the individuals and people that are cared for in the nursing centers. Even more alarming is the fact that an individual, such as a staff member, a healthcare provider, or even a visitor, can contract COVID, bring it into the facility without signs or symptoms, and spread the virus without any indication. In the centers, the residents are part of the family. They need extensive and intimate care with their activities of daily living. The staff feed them, bathe them, help them walk, and yes, the staff hug or even hold their hands. Hands-on care is what occurs. In the initial global shortage of personal protective equipment, made it extremely difficult to prevent the early transmission of this deadly disease. A lack of early, accurate, and timely testing also meant that the facilities were left with few advanced countermeasures beyond the infection control protocols, temperature checks, and screening for symptoms to keep those residents safe from the virus. As we now know, these procedures work best when augmented with accurate and timely testing. Despite all these challenges, the caregivers continue to work and implement the procedures to reduce the spread of the viruses as the science became available. Each facility took drastic measures, ceased visitation, limited group activities, discontinued congregate dining, found creative ways to stretch personal protective equipment, created isolation means to keep residents with COVID separated from residents without. But the inevitable onset of a small outbreak in a wing or a floor could mean risking the safety and health of the residents and staff, not to mention the physical, the mental and psychosocial health of the residents, the staff, and the families with all these drastic measures. Making the work even more difficult were the conflicting governmental directives and guidance, which was changing daily, not weekly, but daily, as experts and healthcare professionals attempted to understand the virus and the effects of the unprecedented pandemic. The 43 long-term care facilities are located throughout the state, and there were instances where local county authorities would issue directives in contrast with their neighboring county, or even more concerning, the state or federal issued mandates. Some counties required residents to be isolated in rooms with their doors closed. That is not normal practice, which was well outside the norm, and how staff were trained to care for patients all along. County personal protective equipment mandates ranged from double surgical masks to wearing cloth facial masks. The caregivers who work in the facilities did the best job they could, keeping their residents safe with the resources and the information they had at that time. They were left to make clinical life-saving decisions in either the absence of guidance or the presence of conflicting guidance. Standards across all three levels of the governments, from the federal CDC and CMS, which regulates our facilities, to the State Department of Health, Agency for Healthcare Administration, the Department of Emergency Management, and all local and county authorities. I'm here before you today because the threat of litigation against long-term care professionals is not theoretical, it's real and it's ongoing. to date across the 43 centers. 27 pre-suit actions have been received in the form of notices of intent or medical record requests. From my perspective as an operator, these potential lawsuits send a dangerous message to the healthcare heroes on the front lines that those clinic life-saving decisions that they made to safeguard their residents will be used against them. Defending against these claims are only going to divert extensive time and financial resources that would otherwise be going into resident care. I've devoted 36 years of my professional life to caring for residents in long-term care, and I couldn't be prouder of the heroic staff in the centers that continue to report to work each day with the same courage and resolve that they have exhibited since this pandemic began. Long-term care professionals remain on that front line today. The nurses and direct care staff continue to put the needs of the residents first while risking their own lives. While there is some light at the end of the tunnel with the vaccines underway, we know our work is not done. We need to ensure every resident is fully protected from the threat of this virus. I ask that you do your part and enact liability reforms that provide protection against the wave of lawsuits that are sure to come. Thank you for inviting me here today. Thanks for your support for reforms.
Thank you, Mr. Beal. We will be moving on to the other side of this debate. We'll begin with Tom Edwards. Mr. Edwards, you are recognized. Excuse me, Mr. Edwards, you need to unmute. There you are.
Are you able to hear me?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Thank you for inviting us to be heard on this. I come to this with I come from a family of doctors. I started my career actually in law school working for the FMA and for FIPIC, the largest malpractice carrier in the state, and started my career defending doctors, hospitals, nursing homes, corporations, and insurance companies. I migrated to the other side. And I've spent many years also interacting with the legislature on issues on behalf of consumers. Your responsibility is difficult in a difficult time. The health and safety of the citizens of our state is the first responsibility of our government. And not far behind that is the welfare of the state, and that includes a functioning economy. And so there's a balance that needs to be struck. I'm going to change my remarks some because there are some things that have been said that I think need some explanation. There have been issues, legitimate issues raised by the doctor about fears for himself and for his staff and liability fears that when you really understand how the legal system works are not legitimate fears. They are fears that are already dealt with in our system. And there are some issues raised by the other speakers that, again, our system already deals with. To some degree, this is what's being proposed by the medical community is a solution in search of a problem. I've supplied in the materials an article published just this past week in the Orlando Sentinel, an op-ed by a physician out of Gainesville who's an infectious disease physician, and I hope you'll all take the time to read it later. It lays out why immunity is a bad thing to head down. It's bad for our state. It's bad for business. It is going to protract the pandemic. The problem you have is if you grant immunity, then if there are a handful of bad actors in any community, that is going to increase the number of cases in those communities instead of helping us stamp out this pandemic. And you are going to expose more healthcare workers, first responders, and others to these problems while also extending the pandemic and our economy being shut down. So let me talk to you in terms of how the system works and why some of the fears that are being advanced are fears that don't need to be don't need to result in immunity. First of all, the statistics that I've looked up as of yesterday show that there is not a flood of lawsuits arising out of these issues. There are currently 6 lawsuits in our state that involve personal injury claims or death claims related to COVID issues. There are a lot of lawsuits where businesses are suing insurance carriers who have denied loss of business claims. There are a lot of workers' comp lawsuits. In fact, one of the things that I think I need to say on behalf of the medical community, which none of them have addressed, is our first responders and our healthcare practitioners, like the doctor on here today, are all exposed to COVID potentially on a daily basis. 65% of comp COVID claims that have been made are from the healthcare community. They are people that work in the healthcare community, and they are being denied at a rate of 60 to 70% by the insurance carriers for a variety of reasons, claiming they can't prove that they got COVID at work. You need to address that. Our healthcare workers deserve better than that, and if they get sick while they're forced to go on the front lines to deal with people with COVID every day, they should get protection through workers' comp. But let me talk to you about how the legal system works. There are already standards in the healthcare community that we are required to get affidavits and testimony in advance of bringing claims. You were supplied also in your materials the Florida Standard Jury Instructions. I have served on the Florida Supreme Court, Florida Standard Jury Instructions Committee. We are only allowed to recommend to the Supreme Court jury instructions based on well-settled law that's been in place for many years. The jury instruction I supplied you specifically talks about any lawsuit the jury is allowed to take into consideration all surrounding circumstances. So some of the concerns that were raised earlier about there was an executive order prohibiting people from being seen because they wanted doctors and healthcare facilities dealing with emergent matters rather than run-of-the-mill matters. When you have lack of PPE, when hospitals, nursing homes, doctors' offices can't get PPE, so they can't safely see patients. When you have instances of unavailability of services, that is not something we can sue for. If a doctor can't get PPE, if they can't get their staff in because people are on quarantine, we can't sue for that. And there is already a standard in this state called Daubert that was adopted a couple of years ago where judges are allowed to pre-vet expert opinions and go through and determine whether they are based on current standards that are applicable to the circumstances of the case. I published an article in the Florida Bar Journal this past year in the March-April timeframe that lays out what those standards are, and judges are authorized to throw cases out if they aren't rested on solid foundation, including current standards and standards that fit that particular case.
Mr. Edwards, sir?
Yes, ma'am.
You're about the same exceeding of 1 minute that everybody else has done, so if you would mind holding the rest of your comments till questions. I'm sure you'll have questions that you'll be able to express the thoughts that you want to share with us. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
Thank you.
So we can continue to move forward. Going to recognize Mr. Brooks. Mr. Brooks, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the other senior members of the committee for having here today. The National Consumer Voice.
Mr. Brooks, I'm going to have to ask you to hold for just 1 minute, sir. Sir. Mr. Brooks, if you can hear me, it's very difficult to hear you. It's muffled. Okay, sir, go ahead and try again.
Is that any better?
Well, we're going
to. Any better?
That's perfect.
Is it better?
There you are.
I don't know. I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't know. My computer might have gone to sleep. I apologize.
No worries, sir. Go ahead and start from the beginning.
Do you want me to start?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So the National Consumer Voice. The National Consumer Voice for Quality Long-Term Care is a national nonprofit organization whose primary purpose is to advocate on behalf of residents in long-term care facilities. Since the beginning of the pandemic, we have focused primarily on increasing protections for residents of long-term care facilities by addressing a variety of issues, including this issue of immunity and civil liability protections. As we are well aware, all of us, that residents of long-term care facilities have paid the highest price during the pandemic. That's in the country and in Florida. Over 100,000 staff and residents of long-term care facilities have died from COVID. But residents are not just dying and suffering from COVID. They are also suffering from isolation and inadequate care brought on by the lockdown of facilities. A recent Associated Press article found that there have been 40,000 excess deaths of nursing home residents across the country during the pandemic that aren't attributable to COVID-19. Sadly, much of the death and suffering could have been avoided. Years of cost-cutting and short-staffing in nursing homes resulted in many facilities being completely unprepared to protect and care for our most vulnerable citizens. According to the GAO, prior to the pandemic, 82% of nursing homes in the United States had an infection control violation, with half of those having repeated problems. As recently as August, the head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services told nursing home providers that basic infection control procedures such as hand washing were still not being followed. This devastation was not inevitable. Indeed, recent studies have shown that facilities who invested in staffing and care quality prior to the pandemic had fewer outbreaks and less deaths. This week, I looked at the data on nursing homes in Florida. According to the CDC and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, there have been over 3,100 deaths in Florida nursing homes from June 1st to the, December 22nd. Facility-level data showed that homes that were rated poorly by CMS and overall and staff ratings fared much worse than five-star homes. The COVID-19 infection rate was 1.4 times higher in homes with one-star ratings as compared to homes with five-star ratings. Homes with one-star rating had a death rate 1.7 times higher than homes with five-star ratings. These contrasts are present for staff ratings as well. The lowest rated nursing homes regarding staff by CMS, their death rate was 1.8 times higher than the highest rated homes. That's almost two times higher. These are pronounced differences that reflect that facilities were not powerless in front of COVID-19, but that those facilities that residents of facilities that invested in quality care and staffing died at rates significantly lower than their counterparts. Immunity from liability protects these bad actors. It shields them from accountability for years of poor care and says that while thousands of Floridians paid with their lives, nursing homes will not have to pay at all. And liability is not just about lawsuits. As the doctor indicated earlier, it's about standards of care. We all go to the doctor and expect those doctors to act reasonably. We do not want to sue. We just want to receive proper care and treatment and not be harmed. Yet, how many of us would go to doctors if they had a license to act unreasonably and face no repercussions? We provide nursing home residents and other patients a day in court because we know this incentivizes facilities to comply with laws and regulations. Immunizing nursing homes from negligence sanctions unreasonable care that harms and even kills residents. Residents now, especially Floridian residents, need more protections, not less. For more than 6 months, there was no outside eyes in facilities, as was noted before. Family members were not allowed in to provide care and monitor conditions. Nursing home ombudsmen were prohibited from entering, and surveyors, the regulators, were not allowed in facilities. At the same time, residents, families, and ombudsmen told us about severe shortages of staff, where one nursing aide was assigned to care for 15, 20, or even 25 residents. In an informal survey, Consumer Voice did of family members who were permitted short in-person visits with their loved ones in late summer and early fall, the overwhelming majority shared stories, extreme late loss, bed sores, drugging, and numerous other examples of neglect and abuse. In many situations, the courts may be the only potential source of justice for residents who were harmed, and accountability for nursing homes who failed to provide even basic care. Removing assets to the courts would be devastating and perpetuate harm to residents. And lastly, immunity for nursing homes is not about protecting frontline workers. Workers on the front lines are rarely, if ever, sued. In fact, immunity could make workers less safe by allowing conditions to deteriorate inside of facilities. That is why worker groups like the SEIU vocally oppose immunity for nursing homes. Nursing homes and other medical facilities are not like other businesses. They are already highly regulated institutions charged with providing the care and services needed by their residents, food, hydration, continence care, as well as protection from contagious and infectious disease. The failure of them to do so should not be rewarded with immunity. We must protect current and future residents of long-term care facilities and other patients by increasing protections, not eliminating them. Again, thank you for allowing me to be here today, and I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee. Thank you.
All right, thank you to all of our panelists, members. Are there any questions? And I'm echoing on somebody's computer. Members, do we have any questions? My members. Representative Masullo, you have a question? You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is to you, Mr. Edwards, and thank you for your testimony. During your time at the FMA, have you ever done any investigation on the cost of just bringing a lawsuit, cost of the defendant to the plaintiff's counsel and the state through the court, whether that suit actually is pursued to some either a settlement of sorts or is just dismissed?
You're recognized to answer that question. Sir, you have to unmute yourself again. Sir?
Are you able to hear me?
Yes, now we can. Thank you.
Okay. I am certain that there have been studies on those issues, and some of them have been presented to the legislature in the past. I have not personally been involved in those studies.
Thank you. Representative Benjamin, did you have a question? You're recognized.
Madam Chair, one of the things that I do in my professional career is a mediator. And oftentimes I find it helpful to be able to frame an issue. And as I listen to the panelists speak with regards to this issue of liability, the things that stood out to me was the standard of care. Physicians are concerned whether the standard of care was interrupted by the COVID and whether they should be held liable to a standard of care that they could not perform because of things outside of their control. And any panelists that represented the medical profession through the chair, if you could tell me if I'm right in that regard, is that a proper framing of your issue?
Yes, sir.
Is that Dr. Golden?
Yes, it is. That is definitely a concern that we will not be able to meet the same standards because the situation and circumstances have greatly changed over the past year.
And
excuse me, Representative Benjamin, I'm going to ask everybody to ask one question at a time so that we've got limited time, and I want to make sure everybody gets questions in. Representative Rayner, you are recognized for a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for Mr. Edwards. And Mr. Edwards, I'm just a simple country lawyer, but I do have a one question. When we're thinking about COVID liability, isn't there also the causation issue of how we're able to ascertain where someone got COVID and how we were in within filing a lawsuit? Could you kind of expound on that? Thank you.
You're recognized? Oh. Mr. Edwards, you need to unmute your microphone.
Are you able to hear me?
We can hear you, yes, sir.
Okay. The answer is you're correct. There are three things that must all come together as a part of a lawsuit. First, you have to prove in a healthcare setting that there was a breach of the standard of care, and that's not the standard of care from the year before, the 10 years before. It is from that time frame. It is from what was going on at that time, and the jury instruction I've already given you says, given all of the surrounding circumstances. Second, you then have to show that breach of that standard of care for that time frame actually caused the harm or the damage that you're seeking. And so there is that middle linkage called causation. And if you can't prove that the failure, for instance, to wash hands and wear a mask by a healthcare practitioner in a nursing home or a doctor's office or a hospital, or the failure to follow some specific CDC guideline that required some type of protective device to avoid a patient getting the COVID, and you can't show that there's a relationship between those actions and the COVID, then you would not be able to prevail in court.
Representative Masullo, did you have another question? You're recognized, sir. Thank you. Representative Davis, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate that. Since we're limited to one question, I better make it good. I'm not sure who to direct this question to, maybe Ms. Maggart. The initial proposals for this type of situation by the provider associations asked for temporary protections. Why are we now considering a change in law?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that, you know, with the pandemic, it creates such an unprecedented time that the unique circumstances that our industry, really across the state, has faced over the past year since COVID started is where we're bringing this request forward. Does that help to answer the question, Representative?
Representative Davis, please answer her question.
Yes, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Just to clarify, everybody can ask multiple questions, but let's just try to do one at a time so that everybody has an opportunity to ask questions. Before we move forward, Vice Chair Grant moves to extend 15 minutes without objection. That motion is adopted. Representative Koster, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair Burton. This question is for Mr. Edwards. You know, we all understand anybody can make any claim that they want to make and say whatever they want to say. And we all also understand that there's a cost to defend those claims even when they're baseless or frivolous. So what, if any, pre-suit requirements or protections already exist within the law or within the legal system for these types of claims that will either eliminate or preclude or whatever these frivolous or baseless claims?
You recognize, Mr. Edwards? Sir, unmute your microphone again.
Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Okay. There are protections on two distinct levels. And the first is a practical protection. And I think the reason why there are only six lawsuits that have been brought in this state. And I will note that when there was comment made about 27 notices of intent, I don't think there was a representation that those were all COVID claims. There are only six lawsuits that we've been able to find that deal with personal injury or death related to COVID claims. Lawyers that do the medical malpractice, long-term care work, both on the plaintiff and the defense, are some of the best and most sophisticated lawyers in the state. We finance these cases. My firm is not taking cases that we can't prove that are going to end up being found to be frivolous, where there are good defenses that the standard of care has changed, and therefore we're not liable, what happened didn't actually cause the COVID that the patient died from. That's not going to happen. I spend $200,000 to $300,000 out of pocket in financing these cases, and I can't afford to lose a bunch of them. So that's the first practical and real protection in the system. The second practical and real protection that's been in the system for a number of years now is, as you've already heard talked about, the phrase notice of intent was used. We have to give notice in advance if we're going to bring a claim in a healthcare case, and it has to be given in detail. We have to lay out what was done wrong, and in most of the cases, we have to also go get an affidavit from a healthcare practitioner in a related field, field related to the issue, where they lay out what the standard of care was and how it was breached. As I've already said, there are also protections in the system where the judge is able to look at those issues and determine whether there was actually a breach of the current standard of care based upon peer-reviewed materials. And if you can't prove that, you're going to be thrown out of court.
Representative Grant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is directed to Mr. Beal. Earlier in his testimony, Mr. Edwards spoke about the balance between our individual patient care responsibilities as a nursing home provider and the standard of care that we have to practice across the board. Could you give me an instance or give me some information, I should say, about how these lawsuits impact your bottom line directly? If you get a notice of intent to suit, does your insurance company in the following years increase your rates? I'm looking at this because at the end of the day, most of the patients in your facilities are there getting paid under government dollars, basically, either federal or state, either Medicare or Medicaid. We end up, as the citizens, paying for all that. So I'm just trying to determine if your rates are going to go up, your costs are going to go up, we're going to have to reimburse that. That's going to have to come out of some other program or something else is going to get cut. So if you could address that, I'd appreciate that.
You're recognized.
Thank you for the question. So, you know, there are different types of insurance coverages, and I can't speak to of the 700 nursing facilities here in Florida that their types of insurance coverages, but I can tell you that depending upon that insurance coverage, there is obviously the deductible amounts of that. But then if you're in a self-insured plan, that money can come straight out of the accounts. That can't be used for other things. If you're part of a different group plan, then it's covered by the insurance, but then at the end of the day, based upon the history, sure, your premiums could go up. Generally speaking, general liability, professional liability costs increase by a couple percentage points each year in healthcare for you know, bad years, good years, maybe not as much. So then those costs then are recorded in the cost reports for both Medicare and Medicaid. And depending upon where you set in your rate setting, it is possible that the rates could be enhanced and then would cost the taxpayers more money.
Representative Skidmore, you are recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think my question is to Mr. Brooks. In an unprecedented time and unknown territory with thousands of businesses being in lockdown as we tried to get our arms around the science of this virus, was it not increasing protections for nursing home residents to eliminate visitors, whether those were family members or administrators or anyone else? There's nothing more heartbreaking, I think, than the isolation, obviously, of someone in a facility, whether that's a hospital or a nursing home, going through this alone without their family members. But was that not an increased protection on the basis of the nursing home to try and stop the spread of the virus? And if not, what would you have recommended instead of not allowing additional folks inside those facilities? Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. And just to be clear, it wasn't nursing homes that made that decision. It was an order by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services on March 13th. And I agree. I think it became tremendously clear that nursing homes were paying the highest price in us not being prepared. And I think locking down the facilities initially probably was the right step. I think as time passed and as became clear that this was going to become prolonged, that there should have been some changes to that. And I think CMS, the federal regulator, agreed to that as well, issuing guidance that visitation for issues of compassionate care, where residents were starting to decline cognitively, physically, because of the isolation, was implemented, although it wasn't followed as much. But yes, I think initially it was a proper reaction, but I think as time passed, we needed to adapt. We needed to get care to those folks who couldn't be cared for because of shortages. And our best and most wonderful caregivers were family members, and they were shut out. And through proper infection control procedures, we strongly believe they could have been an asset during this pandemic to our most vulnerable and struggling residents.
Representative Altman, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Tom. On those six cases that you mentioned, are any of those class action cases or a representation of multiple plaintiffs, or are they all just individuals?
You're recognized. It sounds not on.
Are you able to hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Representative Altman, it is my understanding that those six cases are individual cases and not class actions.
Representative Rayner, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for Mr. Edwards. And I want to, when we talk about the standard of care, and especially when we talk about it within filing a lawsuit, we have to remember going back to March 2020, the standard of care with regard to COVID was all over the place. No one really knew anything about COVID. No one really knew anything about what was going on. So how is it, and I think this may also be to Dr. Goldman's point, how are we applying the standard of care with COVID if these lawsuits are coming up, if there was not a consistent standard of care with regard to COVID, especially there was really not federal guidance and the federal government was looking to the states to establish a standard of care with COVID? So I think that may be some of the concern here. And so how are you suggesting, especially as litigators and people moving forward who these lawsuits may come up, how we are defining standard of care with regard to COVID and the COVID-19 pandemic? Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're recognized. Sir, I can't hear you again.
Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Okay. The point you make is, I think, one of the primary reasons why there are almost no lawsuits. The reality is, if there is a fluctuating standard of care, then you have to prove that what the doctor, the hospital, the nursing home, whoever it is, did breached some level of care that was so basic, you can't argue about it. And so when there is a fluctuating and changing standard of care, we're not going to be able to attack in front of a jury the choices made by a doctor or a nurse or a facility when there are differing opinions within the system. That's one of the things we litigate at times. And as I've said before, under the Daubert standard, a judge is going to have the authority to look at it. And if there is no appropriate standard of care that has been violated, they can throw the case out. And because of that, the sophisticated practitioners, which are the vast majority of the people that do this type of work, are not taking cases unless there's something very clear. If you have someone who wasn't following the most basic levels of safe medical practices, as you've already heard from Mr. Brooks, there have been standards in place for years for infection control with hospitals, nursing homes, surgical centers, even doctor's offices that meet certain criteria. And if they're not following the most basic standards of practices that have been in place for years, then they may get sued. But if they are following practices and they're fluctuating standards, then they're going to have protection from the standpoint of being sued.
Representative Caruso, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is directed to Mr. Brooks. I understand negligence is the failure to use reasonable care in light of all relevant surrounding circumstances. Mr. Brooks, could you describe a hypothetical case of medical negligence that is being covered by the proposed immunity legislation that you feel is an overreach of the bill's intent?
Well, you're recognized, Mr. Brooks. Representative Caruso, we don't have a bill right now, but we're not discussing a bill, but just to clarify, you're recognized.
Well, thank you for the question. I mean, we have seen a lot of these bills since almost day one of the pandemic, and there was even some legislation that was recently tried to be passed in the federal government. Reasonableness, and I think Mr. Edwards can speak to this more, I imagine that almost 9 out of 10 cases are based on a negligence theory. They're not based on gross negligence. It's a very hard thing to show. So what's really captured in these things are a lot of just the basic failure to provide care. For instance, a resident, there was one person I was talking to, a resident who wasn't turned, repositioned, and they got COVID. Their symptoms were mild, but they were confined to their bed, and the facility failed to reposition him, and he developed a pressure ulcer and passed away from that. So it's things like that, the basic care that we look to nursing homes to provide, that if overlooked and captured, That type of failure there would be captured by most immunity laws that I've seen that have been introduced across the country. That's a type of scenario that we imagine, just basic care failures such as that. Does that answer your question? I'm sorry.
Yes, it does.
Thank you. Representative Benjamin, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I'm listening to the panelists, it seems that this issue falls down to the difference between the cost of litigation for a tenuous case and the inability to sue at all. And so I'm going to direct this question, I guess, again to Mr. Brooks, if I may, Madam Chair. Why is it important that we are able to explore liability rather than to not be able to look as to whether liability exists at all?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. And I think that's a very important question. I mean, in addition to the already pre-built in protections that providers have that Mr. Edwards talked about, tens of thousands of Americans have died in nursing homes. And accompanying that is tens of thousands of families that don't know what happened. I mean, I have spoken with so many families that say, we got a call on Monday. My dad was diagnosed with it on Wednesday. He died. I haven't heard from the facility since. Exploring liability is also a way to discover what happened to your loved one. A lot of people, not everyone is going to sue because of that. But for some folks, the only way they're going to know what happened to their loved one is through litigation. And again, there's not going to be a flood of these because, again, lawyers aren't going to take cases that don't have merit to them. But there's a whole blackout, really, for 6 months that no one was in facilities except for staff members. And so there's a real concern that if we don't explore liability, we're not going to know what happened. And we don't want this to happen again. And I think that liability in some of these cases is going to be a vehicle to ensuring that we protect our nursing home residents down the line.
Representative Koster, do you have a question? You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Burton. The question's really, I guess, for Mr. Beal or really any of the other proponents of the liability protection. And I don't know who the notices of intent are from, whether they're from residents, family members of residents, or employees of the facilities. But would the liability protection that you're seeking also seek to protect the medical providers from employment-related COVID issues? Or is this really only limiting liability for, you know, medical negligence or wrongful death? Or are we looking at it from the employment-related side as well, or only from the healthcare side?
I think Ms. Maggard would like to answer that question, and maybe Mr. Beal as well. But Ms. Maggard, since you haven't gotten an answer question yet, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I would agree that we would ask for potential liability in a number of angles, both as an employer as well as a provider of care. I think we have exposure just as businesses do. In addition, if I could respond to the questions earlier, I think it was a great point brought up on unknown standard of care, and that because we're in this pandemic, have been in this pandemic, it really brings into question that unknown standard of care, and that we wouldn't be looking to request complete immunity, but that the level of gross negligence be raised during the pandemic because of the variety of moving parts, the evolution of the virus, the unknowns that we faced, especially early on. So thank you for the questions.
Okay, members, we are down to our last 5 minutes, and I want to thank, see no more questions. I want to thank our panelists for spending this part of your morning with us, bringing us your experience and your expertise, and certainly thank you to our committee members for asking pertinent and thought-provoking questions. At this point in time, this is the only item, the last item on our agenda. I will remind you that you have packets that have been emailed to you regarding all the other work that we'll be doing this session in this committee. So please take the time to review the information in those packets. It'll be important for you to be informed as we move forward. This does conclude our meeting agenda, and Vice Chair Grant moves we rise without objection. This meeting is adjourned.